So let's first of all unbundle the things that are unrelated to each other. Then let's consolidate some of these crimes. So if there are 15 versions of fraud, let's put it all in one statute with an appendix that we sort of update over time instead of having 15 versions of fraud. Then I start talking about things like, we also should, by the way, label them correctly. So I actually think it's very problematic that everyone thinks there's a thing called honest services fraud. I don't really think that's fraud. I think that's bribery. And I think it would be helpful if we actually all admitted what it was. So there's a labeling thing in there.
You're listening to Bite-Sized Business Law, where we discuss big issues in small doses. This podcast is sponsored by the Fordham University School of Law Corporate Law Center, which is run by Fordham Law Professor Richard Squire and me, your host, Amy Martella. Okay, let's get down to business.
Welcome back to Bite-Sized Business Law. Many legal scholars have argued for years that the federal criminal code is broken, but today's guest shines a light on one particular area of the federal criminal code, white-collar and corporate crime, and prescribes a set of attainable steps we can take to address the shortcomings in our financial crime statutes. Miriam Baer is the Vice Dean and a Centennial Professor of Law at Brooklyn Law School. Her research is focused on the intersection between business and criminal law, and her work has been published in leading law journals. It was during her visit as a fellow at the Harvard Safra Center for Ethics that Miriam worked on the fabulous book we'll be discussing today, Myths and Misunderstandings in White-Collar Crime. Miriam and I also clerked for the same judge, the inimitable Jane Roth of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, the beginning of our careers, and I'm so happy to reconnect with you today. Miriam, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. I loved this book. I think everyone who picks it up will also love it, whether you're a lawyer, a government employee or not. It's really got loads of interesting anecdotes and questions and a lot of good ideas for how we can do better in this area. But so let me start with asking you, what inspired you to write Myths and Misunderstandings in White-Collar Crime?
So obviously, I've been a professor now for about 15 or 16 years. Prior to that, I'd spent a little bit of time in corporate compliance, but before that, I'd been a federal prosecutor. So when I first became a professor, I was immediately struck by the difference between federal criminal law and state criminal law, because as a professor, when I taught criminal law, what you teach in that first year criminal law course, a big chunk is you focus on something like homicide. And homicide, what isn't just one crime, it's a series of graded statutes, first degree murder, second degree, third degree. And so you're immediately thinking about the ways in which statutes are making distinctions in a family of offenses, right? That there's a worse version of killing someone and then just a merely bad version, right? And how does the law distinguish that? And that's actually built into the Model Penal Code. When you look at the very beginning of the Model Penal Code and it talks about what its aims are, one of its aims are finding principled variations in a family of offenses. And that was immediately interesting to me because, of course, in federal criminal law, now putting aside the drug statutes, but like certainly talking about mail fraud, wire fraud, and those had been the kinds of cases I'd focused on at the end of my career at the U.S. Attorney's Office, we don't have anything like that. The sorting, to the extent you're sorting cases, is all done at the back end in sentencing. So sure, we have sentencing guidelines that make a big distinction between, say, the garden variety fraud offense and the cryptocurrency caper of SBF, but actually, both of those two folks would be charged under the same mail fraud statute. And so that was already striking to me just when I started teaching. And then I started writing about these areas. I really got my start talking about corporate crime. Eventually, I was writing about white-collar crime. And about 5 years ago, I started saying, wow, I really want a broader audience to be interested in this area, right? Because I was particularly struck by every time there was some sort of big scandal and somebody was arrested, I would hear someone say on television, so-and-so faces as much as 40 years in jail. And what they really meant was so-and-so has been charged in two counts of mail fraud, or so-and-so has been charged in two counts of wire fraud. And as someone who had practiced in this area, I would sit there watching my TV and say, no, they're not looking at 40 years in jail. Right. If you know anything about the sentencing guidelines, you knew that that person was facing realistically a much smaller sentence. And so there came a point where I wanted to stop yelling at my television and put my thoughts to more productive use. And so about 3 or 4 years ago, I put together the proposal for this book. And I think the proposal was accepted by my press, which is Cambridge University Press, in the fall of 2019. And then, of course, COVID hit. So I did my best to start working on the book. And then I had a really great opportunity during my sabbatical year. I became a fellow at the Suffer Center, so I could spend some time there. And I really used that time to dig into the book and the ideas in the book. And that's actually when I really started developing sort of the reform suggestions that are at the end of the book. The book is really intended not just for people who happen to be law professors, but I really wanted this to be a much broader audience of people who care about and think about corporate and white collar crime, whether you're at a business school or you're a student or you're someone in government. I really wanted multiple audiences to be looking at these issues and understanding that it's really easy to say that everything that's wrong with white collar crime is the prosecutor's fault. And I want to shine a light on other sources of our problems.
Okay. And now, what do you mean definitionally by white collar crime?
So this has been a longstanding debate of how do we go about defining white collar crime. The term itself was coined by Edwin Sutherland, who was a sociologist, in his address to the American Sociological Society. This was 1939. He was speaking about a certain type of offender. Okay, so he was making a normative claim that people of high social status can do great harm and that we shouldn't assume that, you know, we shouldn't think solely in terms of street crime. So he was really thinking about people who exploit others through their high social status. And he wasn't necessarily just talking about behaviors that are specifically defined as crimes. So there's always been an offender-based theory of white-collar crime. I totally agree that it's out there, it's important. But for my purposes, I'm interested in what we would call the offense-based definition of white-collar crime, meaning it's a category of statutes and offenses that we agree can be sort of put together in the same group. And usually we would say these are crimes of deception, violations of trust, usually meant to separate someone either from their money, their property, or to undermine systems for some sort of personal advantage. So I would agree that I think actually that a lot of regulatory crimes, obstruction of justice, I would put that in the same group as, say, fraud or bribery.
Okay. So before we get to the reforms that you mentioned and the offense-based approach that you take in this book, it's important to understand kind of what the problem is. And you open the book with explaining that there's kind of two things happening. One, there's an overcriminalization perception, and two, there's an under-enforcement perception. And what's interesting that you just said, the white-collar crime, what was his name, Ed Sutherland?
Edwin Sutherland, yep.
Edwin Sutherland kind of had this offender approach where, you know, it's white collar. It's someone of a higher socioeconomic class who's committing a crime, a financial crime. But actually, it can be applied really to anybody who, you know, ends up finding themselves in that situations, the situations you described. So you have two incredible examples that I think a lot of people will know the first one, and not a lot of people might know the second one, but it's actually shocking. So I was hoping you could first tell us what you mean by overcriminalization and under-enforcement, and then talk to us about John Yates and also the college admission scandal.
Sure. Okay. So with regard to, you know, criminal law, so just putting aside white collar crime, criminal law right now, it's not hard to find any number of examples of what you would call the overcriminalization critique. Many people also refer to it as the mass incarceration problem we have. And many, many people, both within the academy and outside the academy, have very eloquently shown the ways in which criminal law is overcriminalized and has caused terrible harm for many people, but most notably people of color, right? So white collar crime shares some of those traits in that you can absolutely see claims that white collar crime has gone too far. You can see arguments of overreach. And particularly, you've seen arguments that the codes and the statutes are so broadly written that they sort of overcriminalize in the sense that they criminalize what many of us would call borderline conduct, right? And so that's the overcriminalization critique. And you can see it showing up in white collar crime in various ways. And that also people who committed those crimes are often, or not often, it certainly in certain instances are being overpunished. And that sort of shows up in the Yates case that I'm going to talk about in a minute. But at the same time, white collar crime is different from the rest of criminal law, and that you also see just as passionate an argument that white collar crime has been under enforced. And that is particularly true of instances such as the financial crisis, the 2008 financial crisis, right? There was a huge drumbeat that said, hey, where are the prosecutions of the CEOs of the various financial institutions that, I'm just going to say this in a sort of vernacular, caused this mess, right? There's a view that there were folks who should have been prosecuted. And some of that was just from commentators without legal experience, but then there were certain very expert commentators, like, for example, Judge Rakoff, who wrote a very famous piece in the New York Review of Books that really said, why haven't we prosecuted more people who were responsible for the financial crisis? So that's an example of the under-enforcement critique. Now, one way to rationalize those two competing strains is to say, well, yeah, sure, the government under-enforces white-collar crime with regard to the most powerful folks, wealthy folks, i.e. those at the top of big corporations and financial institutions, and it over-criminalizes with respect to sort of the middle class, lower class folks who get caught up in crimes like mail fraud and wire fraud prosecutions. And what I actually say in the book is, I don't think it's as easy a narrative as that. You can find examples of super wealthy people who are caught up in prosecutions that some people have later said were overreach. You can find examples of the government absolutely wanting to try to go after super wealthy people because it, and super powerful people, because it makes them be able to say, we care about these types of cases, i.e. it's not in the book, obviously, but the SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried prosecution we've just seen. That was an example where the government absolutely pursued someone with who was certainly would have been seen as powerful and wealthy. And in fact, they made a point of saying afterwards, we want to make sure that you all understand the law applies equally to everybody, right? So I don't buy that argument that says, well, it's the prosecutors just want to go after the unpowerful and they don't care about the powerful. I actually think they do care. So I actually say, look, there are other things going on here, right? And there are other dynamics. We need to look at those dynamics. And so that's part of it. Now, one of those dynamics is how our statutes are written. Our statutes are written in a way that make us get confused, that make it look like the government is overcriminalizing even when it isn't, or that make it look like it's overcriminalizing more than it than you might say it should be. So the example I give is this fisherman case. So John Yates is this commercial fisherman, and okay, again, if he alleged, I should say he's been prosecuted and he was convicted at a trial. But what is the allegation? The allegation is he's fishing for grouper. He's apparently, according to someone who comes onto his boat from fisheries, says, oh, you have the wrong size grouper, right? So in other words, there are certain regulations on how large your grouper can be. And his, I think, are too short. And so he should have been throwing them back into the ocean. And so he's basically told, take all your grouper, the wrong size, put them separately in the hold. We'll weigh them when you get to port. And that's going to be the basis of your fine. Right? That's really what he was looking at. He wasn't punished for that or criminally prosecuted for that. But when he gets to port, the fish have suddenly grown. And so suddenly he's not, in other words, whereas before he had the wrong fish, now it seems like he has the right fish. Someone in his crew admits that he essentially swapped the fish before he got to port. He was essentially, so the government says, hey, you were obstructing justice in order to avoid a fine. Right? You swapped out the bad fish with good fish so you wouldn't have to pay a fine. That's obstruction of justice. And he's charged under an obstruction of justice statute that, if I remember correctly, again, if you were looking just at the statutory maximum, carries a sentence of 20 years. Now, that 20 years isn't intended for every single person charged under the statute. In fact, it's, and this is the problem with these statutory maximum. They're not intended to cover every single crime. They're simply telling the judge it's 0 to 20. Everything that comes before you falls within that group. And then, of course, you're supposed to use the sentencing guidelines to figure out where the person's actual sentence might fall, although the judge is not bound by the sentencing guidelines. And so this raises this question is, how much real time is this person facing? The Supreme Court, anyway, the case goes to the Supreme Court. The question is a fish a tangible object? Because that's the actual language that's described in the statute, is you're not allowed to deface or conceal a tangible object, right, to obstruct a proceeding or an investigation. So interestingly enough, what you have is the court ultimately decides that this wasn't what Congress meant when they enacted this law. What they really were talking about was sort of like, you know, documents that would have been like data or documents or something, you know, some sort of financial documents, something of that sort, but that it wouldn't have been the actual tangible fish. Justice Kagan writes a very stirring dissent in which she says, what are you talking about? Tangible object is tangible fish or tangible objects. And she also points out it's kind of arbitrary to say that Congress would have had no problem with him destroying fish. And yet it would have said, everyone would have agreed that if he had destroyed like the logs, like some sort of spreadsheet, that everyone would have said, oh, yeah, that fits within the statute. And at the end, she says the real reason everyone's animated by this case is the fear of overcriminalization. And as she points out, he's not really necessarily being overpunished here. But since the statute is, as she puts it, undifferentiated, it looks like he's facing as much as 20 years. And then she says, if you have an issue with that statute, that's a pathology with the rest of the code. So my book is saying, hey, yeah, you're right. That's a pathology with, or at least a big chunk of the white collar code. And my point is, it's not just about this one guy, John Yates, who was facing this situation, which again, it's sort of unclear, was he really truly worried about 20 years? I'm sure what he was really truly worried about was he was prosecuted at all, right? But, you know, and there's a real question of should this kind of case be prosecuted at all? One of the questions I have, when it's hard to even have that discussion until you sort of clear out the distractor of how much time is he really facing? So I think there's a conversation there, should this thing be federalized? But before you even get to that, you have to ask, what is he really facing in the first place? I would say one thing that all of this demonstrates, and I use a metaphor throughout the book that I think the Yates case nicely demonstrates, is that Yates has been prosecuted under what I call an umbrella statute. So if you think about the state world, the states, and this is when I taught state crimes like homicide, if I had a visual for state crimes and state statutes, I'd say a lot of it looks like a series of steps. So a penal code is a series of steps where it's, you know, first degree, second degree, third degree, fourth degree. And usually first degree is the most serious crime. And then as you get farther out, there are less serious versions of the same crime. And those steps are baked into our national psyche. If you ever watched Law and Order or any kind of movie that involves criminal law, you're used to hearing those words degrees. It creates a signal that all of us understand. And that signal is helpful on a retail basis, meaning if you tell me I was charged with third degree larceny, you understand something like, okay, that's not as serious as first degree larceny. Right. And by the same token, it allows us to aggregate that information and give us sort of wholesale information about a particular, what was going on in a particular prosecutor's office, right? How many third degree larcenies did they charge this year as opposed to how many first degree larcenies? So it tells you something about the jurisdiction, right? In the federal world, particularly white collar crime, what we have are a bunch of umbrellas, right? Huge statutes that are undifferentiated, that take up a lot, literally everything under the sun. Right. And if in a way it's not just one umbrella, it's multiple overlapping umbrellas. So it's sort of like if you ever been seen an aerial ad for these resorts where you can see lots of umbrellas on top of each other.
That's the criminal code.
What the federal criminal code looks like. And what's the problem with that? You have no idea what's going on underneath.
Right.
You cannot see underneath the umbrellas. And if you cannot see underneath the umbrellas and you don't know what's going on, and that's particularly true of those of if you're an outsider as opposed to an insider, then what do you start to do? You need to construct narratives to understand what's going on. And that's how you glom onto myths and misunderstandings. So that's why these umbrellas are so problematic.
Well, Miriam, let me ask you this, because you make this really jarring point about Yates at some point in the book. So, I mean, it's just a wild case because, as you mentioned, we're left arguing about whether fish are tangible objects under this. But, you know, provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which I understand was meant to criminalize financial crimes, destruction of...
destroying data, destroying document destruction, that kind of stuff, right?
And of course, like in the abstract, I would argue that fish are more tangible than data that could be degraded, destroyed, put beyond firewalls. But here we are because of a point that you make, which is that let's say that instead of John Yates, instead of this fisherman, it was the CEO of Goldman Sachs out on his yacht catching grouper. There's a feeling, right, that we would have been okay with him being arrested and prosecuted and facing 20 years.
And that's what's interesting. He wouldn't have been facing 20 years any more than John Yates was. We would just enjoy the comeuppance of it, which is itself, by the way, a problematic, I think, a problematic instinct.
Absolutely. And so you pointing that out, I was like taking notes in the margins and I just wrote, wow, with an exclamation point, because that's something I thought of. And so you pointed it out and I'm like assessing my own thoughts. I'm like, yeah, I agree. I would have felt much less sympathy toward that person. Like, why is that?
Well, I think that goes to our natural desire for comeuppance, right? And I think that was showing, you were brought up Varsity Blues. I think that's true in the Varsity Blues case. I think that's why so many of the statements, the Varsity Blues complaint is something like 50, it's 50 pages of every single person and every parent and what they said on all those tapes.
Okay, so yeah, so at the other end of the spectrum, we have Yates, which we have a lot of sympathy for. Now talk to us about this end of the spectrum, which was, something we all heard about and read about, and it just felt so terrible that we were thrilled that they were caught, these people.
Right, and by the way, I care a lot about, so make one point clear. Yates is doing something that is still wrongful to the system in the aggregate. So I feel sympathy to Mr. Yates in the sense that I would never, ever want to prosecute him for 20 years. I don't know that there should be no enforcement consequences for what he's doing, because somewhere out there is a commercial fisherman who's following all the rules and who doesn't take the wrong size grouper or the wrong size tuna or the wrong size salmon or whatever it is, because we're talking about not just one regulation, but multiple regulations. And to that guy who's following the rules, that means they have less fish to actually sell at the end of the day. And maybe they have a harder time making their bills. And so if you believe that legal systems that one of the reasons we uphold legal systems is because we want to actually benefit and support the people who are abiding by those systems, there is an argument for punishing John Yates, just not punishing him in the way it appeared he was going to be punished. And again, no one really thought he was going to get 20 years in jail. And that was, again, what Justice Kagan was saying in her dissent. But that is part of the reason we're twisting ourselves into pretzels, is because of some of these pernicious appearances. And I actually point out with Yates, he also was charged under a misdemeanor that nobody even talks about, that he himself does not challenge. So if this had been a if the federal code was carved into lower level felony offenses, it's not clear to me this goes anywhere. And that anyone sitting there saying fish are not tangible objects. Now, getting back though to the Goldman case, is that I actually don't think that you should care. I mean, I'm actually pointing this out. I understand our instinct, but I don't think that the instinct should rule. I actually think if we're living under a rule of law system, then it should really be whoever does this. We have a concern about systems. We have a concern about lying. We have a concern about cheating. Now, to take it to Varsity Blues, my daughter at the time was applying to college when all this stuff came out. Or I think she was in 11th grade, which is in some ways even more important than 12th grade, because it's really everything you do in 11th grade is what matters, right? And I remember calling her and saying, oh my God, you won't believe it. You got to go look online. And her reaction was something like, well, I always thought the system was rigged to begin with. But that was really interesting, right? She had a certain degree of cynicism already. What I think the Varsity Blues did was depict just how badly.
Can you just quickly, for anyone who might not be familiar with it, just give a 2-second background?
So the Varsity Blues case involved, it was actually a multitude. There were multiple schemes that were being fostered by this admissions consultant who ultimately became a cooperator for the government. And so he was this consultant you would hire if your kids were applying to college. And he offered multiple ways to get those kids into very fancy elite colleges by using different types of fraud and bribery. And so, for example, the fraud parts of it might be you asked for special accommodations on the SAT or the ACT, and then as a result, he would have his own proctor come in and essentially take the test. The student didn't realize it. They thought they were taking the test, but then the proctor who worked for the admissions consultant would correct the test so that the test actually was not reflecting the student's actual answer. So there was cheating on the test. There was also, as alleged in the complaint and indictment, there was cheating in the applications in the sense that people were made out, applicants were made out to be great sports athletes when they weren't. And in fact, to the point of literally like photoshopping water polo photos and things like that. And so it made it look like someone was some great athlete when they weren't. And in fact, the coaches who worked for the colleges, and again, this was all alleged in the indictment and complaint, were in on the scheme. In other words, the only way to make this worse is that you had coaches who knew that someone wasn't really, in fact, the great, you know, lacrosse player, soccer player, whatever it is, the person claimed they were a golf player. And so they were also, this was where the whole question was, were they receiving bribes? And so there was also certain additional allegations of bribery. So there were a multitude of allegations being made. And in fact, it's not in this book, but I have an article that I wrote called Square Peg Frogs. In order to sort of fashion these cases into federal cases, you end up having to call the universities victims because they were victims of the honest services fraud that their athletic directors and their coaches were engaging in. And so that itself, I think, is an interesting question of, is that good for society that we end up calling the colleges victims? Because I don't think among lay persons, anyone thought of the colleges involved.
Yeah, I mean, the victims are the other students who legitimately applied and didn't.
Right. And those folks who tried to bring civil suits ultimately were failed. What was interesting also about the Varsity Blues case is we had celebrities who were in the mix. So we had also, this was an example of the government absolutely pursuing the wealthy and the powerful. There was a partner, I think it was at Willkie Farr, who was originally in the mix. There were certainly powerful folks in sort of the corporate world, but there were also celebrities. And so Felicity Huffman was among the parents who were prosecuted, and Lori Loughlin from Full House. And initially, when you heard all of these prosecutions, again, it was not uncommon to hear someone say, so-and-so, because again, they'd be charged in several counts. So it'd be like, so-and-so faces as much as 20 years in prison if convicted, or some very high number. And then of course, ultimately, when all these folks were prosecuted, and many of them pled out, a few have actually appealed their cases, but let's just take the folks who pled out, they received fairly low sentences. A few received more time, and some of that had to do with the nature of their cases, particularly if some people went ahead and there was tax evasion and how they portrayed their payments to the admissions consultant. But most were receiving very modest sentences. Felicity Huffman, I think, received something like 2 weeks in prison, something very, very small. And so again, notice the whiplash that produces, because if you're trying to figure out what happened or why did that person receive such a small sentence, it would be helpful to know how much they were realistically facing in the first place. In other words, what were they really facing under the sentencing lines? Felicity Huffman, whatever you think of her 2-week sentence, she was never facing anything like 20 years to begin with. And so again, it's not helpful to have her charged under the same umbrella statute as someone who's formulated a far more serious scheme. And that's sort of one of my big points, is that these things become very distracting to us. I don't disagree with those who say there are real problems in the system, in how, you know, sort of a wealthier defendant who has access to good attorneys, of course they do better than the defendant who does not. And that's something we should care about. But I think that these statutes are creating distractions and misunderstandings that make it harder for us to have the conversations we need to have.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you had this great quote in this section of the book, but I wasn't sure exactly what you meant by it. So you say, whatever it is that Operation Varsity Blues accomplished, it did not and probably could not address the deeper structural concerns with the college admission process. It may have unearthed and brought attention to a problem, but except in the most superficial ways, it did very little to solve it. Now, is that just your daughter's skepticism about the process in general, or is that a deeper comment on that these types of white collar crimes are underpunished?
So if you think about, there's a thing called the fraud triangle, which was really the, you know, it's talked a lot about in accounting circles. And it was Donald Cressy when he was looking at embezzlers. He was a criminologist in the 1950s. And it was his idea, but it was coined by someone else, the word triangle. But this idea of, you know, what breeds this kind of behavior, right? And the standard view is that it's some mixture of pressure, opportunity, rationalizations. Do I think any of that has gone away in the world of college admissions? No, because we have a winner-take-all type of market. In other words, people have convinced themselves that they absolutely positively have to get into certain schools. I think that kind of mindset is still out there for a group of people. Pressure. Is there opportunity? I think definitely schools have changed. And so I don't mean to say that there's the exact same scheme someone could do today, what they did 5 years ago, but there's still opportunity across multiple institutions insofar as you're talking about massive institutions we don't really know about. You know, they all have compliance programs and whatnot, but there's always going to be some other new scheme out there that someone can devise. I find it hard to believe that there aren't other schemes being devised. And then rationalizations, I think we absolutely can imagine the same. And it was interesting to read some of the sentencing letters that, you know, I read Felicity Huffman's sentencing letter. A lot of this is going to be chalked up to, I was just trying to be a good parent. I loved my child so much, I was trying to be a good parent. So that's why I have a hard time believing that this, and again, that in other words, enforcement by itself of a handful of people is going to somehow change all of these institutions. That just doesn't seem plausible to me. And my big shtick is always, what could we do instead? Probably we could put more of our resources towards front-end regulation, right? And that's all I was really trying to say there. That this idea, you're incredibly naive if you think that, what, 5 years from now, someone's going to say to themselves, but remember Felicity Huffman. I don't see that one happening.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that this type of high-profile prosecution produces some deterrent effect, but you also have another great line where you say, crime operates hydraulically. When you close off one end of the system, water flows to the other end. So that goes to your point of like, people will always figure out another way to get around.
That idea comes from the great William Stuntz, Bill Stuntz is all over this, but I cite him a lot and quote him a lot. But the idea of the hydraulic nature of criminal law, I mean, this is always a problem in enforcement. And you're naive. And again, the question would be, well, what should we do instead? And it's not that, you know, you have a real question here. Maybe you should still prosecute. I think there are a number of aspects of Varsity Blue, certainly the folks who were also engaging in tax evasion, who engaged in bribery. I mean, there are certain folks, again, you had different variations of this, of who was doing what, and they were doing a lot. And so, again, I'm not saying that none of this should be enforced or criminally enforced or even federally criminally enforced, but it does raise questions about, would you have had perhaps better clarity, again, if you had already differences baked into the statutes themselves? Would that have given us a better understanding of what was going on? And however you feel about what's going on, do you really think that criminal law is the answer to all these questions? My guess is that however you feel about education and admissions, that what's going on in the admissions world really needs a greater amount of regulation. By the same way, and again, I say this in my paper, the Square Peg Frauds case paper that I wrote, if you have an issue with, for example, rankings fraud, right? There have been a few schools that have, where their deans have been prosecuted. I'm thinking about Temple's business school, right? In regard to the statements they make and what they're portraying in their information with regard, and basically to get better rankings, they lie about certain things, at least that's the allegations. And again, however you feel about that, criminal enforcement, if you think that's going to, well, now we had that guy was prosecuted, so everything will be fine. That's a very naive way to look at things.
Okay, so it all comes back to what you call flat laws. So can you explain what you mean by flat laws and why it's important to move away from that?
Okay, so this goes to my idea of steps versus umbrellas. And I'm thinking of an umbrella as fairly flat, even though it's a little curved. But a stepped kind of law would be, you know, first degree, second, where you have some type of gradual change in what the law punishes based on some kind of factor. For example, you take something like negligent homicide. Negligent homicide doesn't require nearly as much of the prosecutor. I don't have to show what you're... So, for example, you hit someone with your car and I want to charge you with negligent homicide. I don't have to prove as much with regard to your state of mind. I don't have to prove that, for example, you intended to kill someone and harm them. But I have to show negligence, however that's defined by the particular jurisdiction. But at the same time, I probably, whatever that statute involves, say it's like fourth, you know, negligent homicide in the fourth degree, it probably doesn't carry nearly as much of a punishment. And so, and then if I were to work my way up all the way to first degree murder, well, that would carry a really huge punishment, but wow, probably doesn't require all that much. It requires a lot in terms of proof. I'd have to show that you intended to kill someone, right? One of the things I talk about, so in other words, if you think about it, it's sort of building up to a more serious crime. So that's one type of statutes that we would call stepped or graded statutes. Flat laws are laws that don't have any of those gradations. In other words, they simply say, okay, anywhere from 0 to 20 years, if you commit, you engage in a scheme to defraud using the mails or using the wires. And that's flat in that there's no gradation built into the statute. Everyone's under the same statute. To the extent we sort people or sort the offenses, we're going to do that towards the end in sentencing. Okay, so that's the difference between a flat law and a graded law. And the one of the things I talked about with regard to graded laws is graded laws create for defendants, I talk about this, of proof rights and sealing rights. Okay, so in other words, if you're going to be charged at the top of that graded rubric, well, at least you have some pretty strong proof rights, meaning as a defendant, you can at least say to yourself, well, the government's going to have to prove that I intended this. And that's hard, right, on the government's end. We want it to be hard. It should be hard. On the other hand, I don't have much of a ceiling on the punishment. By contrast, the reciprocal occurs at the bottom. You know, if I'm being charged with a low-level offense, my proof rights may not be, as a practical matter, all that great. I mean, yeah, the government has to prove whatever the elements are beyond a reasonable doubt, but if the element doesn't call for much in terms of my state of mind, my proof rights practically aren't worth as much. But my sealing rights are good because the government can't put me in jail for more than, say, whatever the statute says, 3 years, 5 years, whatever. Under the flat laws, I kind of don't have that same degree of proof rights and sealing rights. There are no real ceilings because I have this statute that's undifferentiated. And so statutorily, that's why you hear these things like she faces as much as 20 or 30 years in jail. Don't have the ceiling. And then proof rights are there, right? But it's sort of, it's not giving me that same degree of comfort. And particularly also if a lot of this stuff is hashed out the sentencing phase, it may not even be subject to proof beyond a reasonable doubt if it's there are certain aspects of the crime that could enhance my sentence. So there are real issues there when you have these flat laws, because you're leaving all the sorting to the sentencing stage, which means not only are there sort of temporal issues, but it's also not necessarily before a jury. So that's a problem.
Why the heck, Miriam, when we were writing the Federal Criminal Code, did we not bother to grade it at all?
So it's sort of interesting, and I am not a historian, but I do throw in a little bit of what I've learned. So first of all, at the founding, we're not really thinking, you know, in the years after the founding, remember, federal criminal law is not a big deal. It's really about a few, it's a handful of statutes meant to truly protect the federal government from things like false claims and stuff like that. So it's not like we're really thinking about federal codes. And also state codes themselves are sort of in their own state of flux. Pennsylvania was the first state to adopt the idea of, you know, graded statutes when it came to homicide. And part of that was to get away from capital offenses because they knew juries weren't going to actually convict someone in situations that didn't warrant the death penalty. So some of this is driven by states are engaging in their own reform. The feds are small. None of this is that important to the feds. And the feds feel sort of, you know, federal government was sort of unmoored from following what the states were doing because the idea was federal government was different. And then over time, it's really post-Civil War that, for example, the mail fraud statute really comes into being. And this is about, this is the beginning of industrialization. And then we are worried about interstate commerce and the use of the mails to actually engage in frauds. So Edward Blazin has a wonderful book on fraud and its actual evolution as both a dynamic, a phenomenon in the United States, but then also on the enforcement approaches. And I can only tell you what a wonderful book it is. And so it's really in the 1880s through, you know, now going into the 1900s that we start to say, hey, we're worried about things like fraud. And then also we start to have new statutes like the wire fraud statute. So now suddenly something could be also, now notice you could have a crime that could involve multiple counts, right? I could include, you know, if I have a scheme, then the scheme involves some use of the mails and some use of emails and the wires and phone calls and interstate wires, the same scheme can now be generating multiple counts. So that too is going to create these problems. And then on top of that, as the federal criminal code grows, eventually, and it's actually not until Sarbanes-Oxley, that we're going to end up increasing the amount of time that, you know, the maximum statutory range for these offenses. So what used to be maybe 0 to 5 years suddenly becomes 0 to 20 years. Now, the Model Penal Code, meanwhile, so go back in time, in the 1962, I think, is when the American Law Institute publishes the Model Penal Code. That was actually like a 15, 20-year project. And that Model Penal Code was intended for the states to try to, even though it includes variation, it was also to try to streamline some of their codes and bring order and coherence to their codes. At that time, there is some interest in, hey, should the federal criminal code adopt some of the Model Penal Code? Should it follow the Model Penal Code? And that goes on and back and forth, and there are commissions and all sorts of things like that. Ultimately, instead, what does the federal government do? Congress adopts Sentencing Reform Act in the 1980s. So the thought was that the guidelines would take the role, right? Oh, we don't need to change all of our code. The guidelines will fix it all. And I think that's a great tragedy. Obviously, the guidelines, I think they've done some good. I disagree with people who say they've done absolutely no good. And in fact, I think it would be silly to get rid of them because I think they're still doing some value, doing some job. But as a result, federal criminal code reform dies. That to me is utterly tragic.
So you did mention to us earlier in the conversation that when you're charged under federal white-collar criminal code, we hear a lot from the media about what you're facing, but you're really never facing that. Not to worry. At the sentencing phase, you will be sentenced to something much lesser because both the prosecutor and the judge, who are smart, competent people, right, who ostensibly want to do the right thing, seek truth and justice, they will flesh out the contours of the crime, of what you deserve, and of the charge all the way to the sentence. So why do we care then that we don't have it graded? Because we're achieving that on the back end. Like, what is so sinister or bad about that?
So I think that is problematic for two reasons. First of all, I think for the person who is actually facing that situation, I've never been in that situation, but I can't imagine that they aren't hearing the number 20, 40, 60, 100. Those are incredibly large numbers. They tend to be round numbers. They tend to be memorable numbers. And they tend to be the numbers that you're going to hear at the very beginning of the case. To the extent there are people out there who are really scared, even if their attorneys say to them, don't worry, but the guidelines, I would worry that there is some group out there that says, I'm going to plead guilty because I'm so scared, even if they have the type of case that maybe I'd like them to go to trial. I'd like them to put the government to the burden of its proof. So there's that. And I also think emotionally, we shouldn't do that to people. Like, I really do think there's something awful about that. And we shouldn't do that to people. Okay. Second, though, even apart from that, of how it is impacting the defendant, there's the additional problem that it still contributes to this information problem that I discussed throughout the book. In other words, yeah, there are the guidelines, and the guidelines provide this kind of detail and contextualization. But we've created a system where it's really our inputs, because it's all these flat laws and everybody's charged under these similar laws, are creating a lot of confusion. That, in other words, I think gradation would do some real work in terms of how we track what the government is doing.
Okay. I want to ask you about tracking, because you're right. You do bring up that up a lot throughout the book. So you refer to this patchwork of tracking systems, right? And this contributes to confusion and also to these myths and misunderstandings. But who's tracking? I mean, I've never heard anyone who's not a lawyer say, muse about like, oh, I wonder how many obstruction of justice cases were brought in my district last week. Like, what is the value of tracking? Is it other prosecutors?
Oh, I think it's tell, but you do hear probably, you probably heard about track. You probably have seen lots of articles that say something like white collar crime prosecutions have fallen dramatically in the last blank years. which it becomes really unclear. Are you talking about fraud cases? Are you talking about all white collar crime? Are you including bribery? Are you including obstruction of justice? How are you taking account crimes that are pleaded out under, for example, 18 USC 371, which is the conspiracy statute, right? I don't know how all those are being done. And on top of that, you do have, and I talk about this, and by the way, others have talked about this, you do have this sort of interoperability problem, which is, in other words, you have, there's one system that's tracking like the what the agencies are doing in terms of arrests and investigations. There's another system that's tracking prosecutions. There's another system that eventually tracks sentences. And there's a huge amount of translation that has to go on to make that all work. Now, I'm not saying my gradation idea would solve all of this. It wouldn't. But I do think having ungraded statutes makes it even worse. And I do think there could be value in knowing, for example, how many cases were originally charged in the first degree and were eventually pled down to the third degree. Whereas I don't think the sentencing guidelines does nearly as much work. I think they make it's much more opaque under the sentencing guidelines. And I think there would be some value in knowing that. And I think as a society, so, okay, maybe the average Joe isn't walking around saying how many obstruction cases were there last year, but there are organizations and crime watcher and, you know, government watching groups, oversight groups, right? Social justice groups that do this kind of work. And I want to make their jobs easier. I want to make the academics' jobs easier, because I think eventually those groups are the groups that do publish things in the media and publish books and publish articles that eventually filter them to the rest of us. And that allows us to make better decisions about reform and who we want to elect and things like that. And that creates accountability, right? We have no accountability because we have opacity.
Yeah. No, it makes sense that if you were required to charge in a more specific way because there were grades, that just the tracking of it just would be better. So, Miriam, how would you grade? Would you grade according to mens rea? Would you grade according to the harm that the crime caused? Like, how would we go about this? It doesn't feel like it can track homicide exactly because there's an intent issue. So what do you think about that?
And I sort of noodle. This is the part where I of the book where I am admittedly most, like I said, look, we can go this way, we can go that way. I sort of go through different methodologies we could use with the idea that, look, I'm not wed to any one methodology. Just for gosh sakes, let's start having the conversation about how to do it. So the book ends with, you know, and grading is just one of the of four prescriptions I make, right? So first I say, hey, there are a bunch of these flat laws that manage to mush a bunch of crimes together. So they're bundled, and that's making it really hard for us to track anything. So let's first of all unbundle the things that are unrelated to each other. Then let's consolidate some of these crimes. So if there are 15 versions of fraud, let's put it all in one statute with an appendix that we sort of update over time instead of having 15 versions of fraud. Then I start talking about things like, we also should, by the way, label them correctly. So I actually think it's very problematic that everyone thinks there's a thing called honest services fraud. I don't really think that's fraud. I think that's bribery. And I think it would be helpful if we actually all admitted what it was. So there's a labeling thing in there. All right. Finally, we get to gradation. And gradation is the hardest thing, the hardest of the four reforms that I'm talking about. So as you said, fraud is different in that you might say, well, you know, homicide, you can kill someone, cause someone's death with any number of mental states. It could be that you intended it, and, you know, we would call it purposeful, and it could be you were reckless, it could be you were negligent, right? All of these are different variations, and that's why we can easily create these degrees. But, and you might say, fraud is all intentional, but that's not quite true. And we're really going to say not quite true. You could still make some gradations based on mens rea. So first of all, let's just take, you can subdivide the purposeful category, because in fact, that happens in homicide in some states. There is a difference between it. So in some states, and all of the folks who are in 1L crim will know what I'm talking about. There is a difference in some states between an intentional killing and a premeditated killing in some states. And the premeditation usually is some idea that you've had some time for reflection, that there is a difference between impulsively killing someone. And in fact, even more importantly, even in states that employ just a purposeful killing, there's usually some sort of partial mitigation. Either it's called heat of passion or extreme emotional disturbance. But both of those reflect usually some sort of impulsive moment of losing control. I don't know why we couldn't apply that into a grading situation when we talk about fraud. We often do hear about the person who sort of acts impulsively in a discrete moment, as opposed to the person who's planned it all along and is very deceptive. And in fact, the sentencing guidelines do, you could argue, take that up a little bit insofar as they talk about things like sophisticated means, or they look at whether or not you are exploiting particularly vulnerable folks or things like that. You could argue that those are serving as proxies for some type of premeditation. So I don't know why we couldn't at least try to come up with some language on that. At the same time, below intention, there are these cases that kind of do seem to stretch fraud beyond, even though we say it's an intentional scheme to defraud, one of the ways you can prove the intentional scheme is like, you know, if someone kind of is almost deliberately indifferent about the truthfulness and veracity of the statements they're making, you can somehow use that and tie that to saying, well, that based on that, I think person engaged in an intentional scheme to defraud. To me, that starts to sound awfully close to some version of reckless fraud, even though courts will say, no, I'm not saying that. And which that then raises the question of, ought there to be some category we call reckless criminal fraud or reckless misrepresentation or something like that? No, but at least if we created the grades, we'd start to have the language and the ability to have that conversation rather than farming this thing out, having this umbrella that you farm out to judges, and then there's all sorts of confusion. So that to me is one of the benefits of grading. I give this example, I use all of these names, and one of which is my daughter's name. I give these examples of like, you know, let me give you an example of different types of harms that my hypothetical person is causing harm. So there's Natalie and there's Marley and there's Rose, and each is doing some bad version of fraud. But one of the things is to try to tug at your heartstrings and see which one do you think is worse. And one thing, when we do talk about harm, I think there's a tendency to think about it in sort of SBF type terms of how many billions of dollars were involved. Like, you know, was it 50 million, 500 million, 500 billion? And the bigger the number, the worse it seems. And yet it seems to me sometimes the worst frauds might be the $300,000 fraud in which you took money from someone who was particularly vulnerable and exploited them. Because to me, that's all what the deception itself is about. And so I actually do think we should think, when we think about the harm, it shouldn't just be a dollar sign. But I do think, again, you could work, it's not unclear to me that you couldn't work that into some good grading system. And to me, that's the type of thing that I want people, and I think that's a valuable thing for people to debate and discuss in the open, available for all of us to comment on.
Yeah, it makes so much sense. And those examples you give of the three or four different women perpetrating different frauds, people are going to love that part, because it's a really fun hypo to unpack. And it takes a couple twists and turns. When you look at it through a mens rea lens, you end up in one place. When you look at through a harm lens, you end up in another place. You're not saying like, here's the answer. You're saying these are important questions that we need to start asking and thinking about. So whose job is this? How do we go about this type of overhaul?
So in the broad sense, whose job is it? It seems to me this is, if we care about both the rule of law, but also our democracy, this is the job of the people through our elected representatives, meaning this is the job of Congress. And this is a critique all along in my book of, I think in spending so much time yelling at prosecutors, we've forgotten the important role of our legislature and federal criminal law. Congress owns it, and we should go back to Congress and we should be saying, hey, we want you to fix our federal criminal code, at least as it pertains to white collar crime. So in terms of who owns this, ultimately it's Congress. Now, to do something like what I'm describing, I think you'd almost certainly have to create some sort of a commission of some sort. And I mean, there, it's, I give only the broadest sketches, because I am not an expert in this kind of federal, I'm not an expert in federal criminal reform. I don't think it's something that should be just the American Law Institute. So the American Law Institute is a nonprofit elite organization of which I'm a member. I think they're wonderful. They are the authors of, for example, restatements. They certainly do write principles, and they wrote the model penal code. I don't think they should write a federal model penal code. I do think, though, it should be the kind of commission that includes multiple stakeholders. I would certainly want defense attorneys. I'd want some type of DOJ presence. You'd want prosecutors, but you don't want prosecutors writing it solely. And I'd want academics, and I want judges. And I think that's where you can get some real value. And I would not focus it on the entire federal criminal code. I think that effort is likely to fail. But if you could say, let's just look at a series of statutes that pertain to fraud, bribery, and obstruction, can we come up with a rubric that works? And the one thing I would do is I wouldn't change the meaning of those statutes insofar. In other words, I want to keep as much of the language as possible, because this is something that came up during one of my other, you know, when I did a book talk, someone said, well, wait, what about all of the cases out there that have interpreted these laws? We don't want to lose that. And I said, I agree with you. So let's not try to, but here's the thing. There are a lot of cases that will say, our findings are equally applicable to mail fraud, wire fraud, securities fraud. So that actually means we can consolidate without losing those cases.
Yeah, you make that point that like judges are consolidating anyway at the sentencing phase.
Yeah, they're consolidating anyway. So this is one area where we actually can do some of that consolidation. Again, with this speed, this is not something that could be solved in a year. This is a long-term project. But the Model Penal Code was a long-term project. Sometimes it's worth it. And I think it would be worth it if we started on this path. Even discussing all this would be valuable.
Well, I think that your book is opening up this path. Everyone has to read Myths and Misunderstandings in White-Collar Crime. It's a perfect roadmap to improve our federal criminal code. And it's got a lot of doable steps laid out. Thought-provoking examples of our blind spots in white-collar crime and ways that we can address them. Miriam, thank you so much for your time today. It was a really fun conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really great being here.
Thanks to everyone at Fordham Law School, especially the Dean's Office and our Corporate Law Center donors for supporting this podcast. Bite-Sized Business Law is produced by We Edit Podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Bite-Sized Business Law on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. The information in this podcast is for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute legal advice, nor is it intended to promote the organizations with which our guests are affiliated. For more information, check out our show notes, and thanks for listening.